Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we have been studying the Nandakovada Sutta. This is Sutta number 146 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is found on page 1120 in the book. Okay, just to recapitulate from last time, in this sutta, the Buddha instructs a monk named Nandaka to give where the Buddha requests a monk named Nandaka to give instructions to the bhikkhunis, to the nuns. And the monks had been taking regular turns and giving instructions to the nuns. And for some reason, this Venerable Nandaka tried to evade taking his turn. But the Buddha gave him a specially strong injunction to give these instructions. And so Venerable Nandaka goes to the nuns' quarters and he gives them a talk in the form of a dialogue of questions and answers. And the dialogue will be based on the six sense bases. Okay, and the first part deals with the focuses upon the six internal sense bases. That is, it starts off from the eye, ear, nose, and so on. Well, actually, it goes from the entire process of cognition, starting with naturally with the eye, then through forms and so on. Each one is being impermanent, as being suffering, subject to change, and then as being not to be regarded as myself. And then it comes into a simile in paragraph 9. The simile that we took last week is that of the oil lamp burning. And then its oil is impermanent, subject to change. The wick is impermanent, subject to change. The flame is impermanent and subject to change. And therefore the radiance or light also must be impermanent and subject to change. And from this, the conclusion comes by comparing the different constituents in the simile to factors in the process of cognition. The conclusion is drawn that whatever feeling arises must be impermanent and subject to change because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition, and so with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. Okay, that's as far as we got last week. Now we come to paragraph 10. Okay, here we're going to use, or Venerable Nandaka is going to use, a different simile to illustrate the impermanence of the external sense basis, that is, the sense objects. Okay, suppose a great tree is standing possessed of heartwood. Heartwood is the solid core of the tree. Okay, now, for this tree, its root is impermanent and subject to change. Its trunk is impermanent and subject to change. And its branches and foliage are impermanent and subject to change. And therefore, its shadow is impermanent and subject to change. Okay, the root, the trunk, the branches and foliage, those are all parts of the tree itself, correct? The shadow is something which is cast by the tree. So this is going to lead into the application of the simile. But let's continue. Okay, now, could one say rightly that the root, trunk, branches, and foliage of this great tree possessed of heartwood are impermanent and subject to change? But its shadow is permanent, everlasting, eternal, and not subject to change. Could that be the case? Can you have a permanent shadow if there's an impermanent tree? Yes or no? No. Okay. So why is this? Okay, you cut down the tree, you cut down the tree at the base, so its trunk goes, the branches go, the foliage go. One cuts up the trunk, cuts up the branches, hauls the trunk away, hauls the branches away, pulls out the roots, cuts up the roots, pulls the roots away. If one wants to make doubly sure that one is getting rid of the shadow, one could put all of the trunk, branches, everything, put it all into the flames, burn it all to cinders, and then no more shadow left, right? Okay, so when the tree vanishes completely, then the shadow has to go. So because the tree is impermanent, the shadow must be impermanent and subject to change. Okay, so now the application of this simile, page 1123. Okay, would anyone be speaking rightly who were to speak thus? These external sense bases, now here the external bases are the sense objects, are impermanent and subject to change, but the pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling, that is the neutral feeling that one experiences in dependence upon these six external bases, is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. Can one be speaking rightly if one were to say that? And now it seems to me somewhat interesting that in the case of the internal sense bases, the simile is given of the oil lamp with its flame burning. That illustrates the internal sense bases. Because maybe, okay, but in the case of the external sense bases, the simile is given of a tree possessed of heartwood. Does there seem to be maybe any rationale behind this difference in the similes? They seem to be just on the same level.
The flame could be an analogy to life.
Okay, that's one interesting similarity. It wasn't quite what I was thinking of, but it also has some validity.
Maybe the tree similes, the external bases, because the shadow is dependent on something external in the tree. Sunlight shining on the tree and projecting the shadow. So there's another external factor involved. The tree similes, it's got to be some kind of light.
I didn't quite understand how it works out. Anybody else have some? Yeah. Yeah, I think this is what I had in mind, that a flame seems to be, already it seems to be something more transient. The transience is more evident in the case of the flame, so that maybe we could see more obviously that the sense faculties are impermanent, but the things in the outer world seem, at first glance, they seem to be quite solid and substantial. You know, this world spread out before us of tables, chairs, cups, these things seem to be really solid and substantial compared to this fragile body with the sense faculties, which can just be crushed and wiped away just in a split second. Okay, but even though the tree appears to be something solid, stable, lasting, if one reflects on the tree, one realizes that the tree also is impermanent. Yeah.
Could the tree be an analogy to the human body? In that, looking at, okay, stand straight, it has more substance than the oil. And that the shadow might correspond to the thought, the foreign process of thoughts that, again, are dependent upon what comes before.
No, because, unless I'm missing something. Yeah. I think it's pretty clear here that the tree represents the six external sense bases. And though, okay, the tree has the root, Actually, last week, I think I took the oil lamp simile, and I tried to apply the oil lamp simile to all, each of them. And then I took the lamp itself representing the external sense face, right? Yeah.
From the end of Jesus' word, the old year and the week, because the week the kingdom is the old year.
Yeah.
It's like the contact sphere. And if you have the craving, and the feeling and the body is the craving, then it's like the lighter, the spot sphere. You know, because when we see, we always have something to see it. So that we don't have the craving, we don't have the feeling, and the lamp just feel there. But the, if you start to have the craving, like the lighter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you start to have the craving, you have the feeling.
Yeah.
The craving, feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. There, but in the simile, the light represents, or the radiance represents the feeling. The craving itself isn't mentioned here, though it's implied. Here it's dealing with the chain of causation up to feeling. But it's sort of implied that, what's implied is that when feeling isn't understood, isn't, when its impermanence is not understood, that this will be the basis for craving to arise. But it is through understanding the feeling, the impermanence of feeling, that craving is prevented from arising. Yeah, let's see what I said last week. Last week I said the oil lamp is like the sense object. The oil is like
the internal or external sense object.
Last week I said the oil lamp is like the external sense object. Did anybody take notes on that? The oil lamp is like the oil wick flame. Did you have notes on it?
Yeah, no, I was focusing on the discussion that we were having, and I didn't take notes on that.
On that simile?
Yeah, because of the simile, because I was trying to understand it from a
perspective. Mm-hmm. So. I think we had them both with the internal and external sense spaces, because I remember Marcy and I commented that, well, then the oxygen must be contact. So I think we were broadening it.
Yeah. Yeah, I brought both in.
Father, I have a different idea.
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to find the relationship between the tree as internal sensations or land. But I think that's not the point.
Yeah.
The point is that whatever is dependent upon something as impermanent, that thing is impermanent.
Yeah, that I know. I just thought that that
necessary to go that far.
Yeah.
To, because he does not say that.
Yeah.
Tree is the internal basis.
Yeah, I know.
Because the internal basis is there is function there.
Yeah.
What is the function of a tree? It's vegetation life. It's not like the human being and other animals. So that does not stand reason to me.
Yeah. Okay, it was a bad idea. I thought, but still, I don't know, I thought that there was some significance in using the oil lamp for the internal sense base.
I have one other thought.
Yeah.
You can throw this out there and then feel free to throw it out the window if you don't like it. But the oil lamp to me is an entirely an internal process.
Yeah.
You have this wick, you have the oil, you have the thing going on, all these processes are going on inside the lamp. So it's very easy to think about all of that in terms of an internal sense base for that activity going on within one's own physical form.
Yeah.
Whereas the tree, when he describes the tree, he's not talking about, you know, what's inside each branch. He's talking about it in terms of all of the external, what you see.
Yeah.
Tree. The I don't know if you see the bark. I don't know if he says the bark, but he says the.
No, he doesn't mention the bark.
The trunk, the
branches and foliage.
Yeah, the pieces that you can see. My understanding is you can see some bits of the roots and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's more of a, and then the shadow itself is something that's very clearly happening to the outside of the tree.
Yeah.
An external thing.
No.
To me, it seems like you're trying to get to impermanence of feeling, and one example is you're looking at an object where you're really thinking about it, about what's inside it.
No.
Whereas the other object, you're thinking about what's on the outside, its shape and its form.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, we go on. Okay, the important point here comes in the sentence, or giving the reason. Okay, why is it that the feeling that one experiences in dependence upon the six external bases, why is that feeling permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change? The reason is given because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition. And with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. We had that sentence also last week in relation to the six internal sense bases. But I got through that a little quickly because we were coming to the end of the period. But I want to go back and then to take this in a little more detail. Because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition. And with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. Okay, so each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition. So there's actually not one single condition upon which feeling arises, but there's actually a bundle of conditions that brings feeling into being. So this bundle of conditions begins with the inner sense base, that's in this case the eye, the outer sense base, the external base, that would be the forms, visible forms. I'm just taking vision, visual experience as an example. And then when in dependence upon the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. And then the coming together of these three, or what is what we call contact. Or as I explain it, contact is the coming together of consciousness with the object through the sense faculty. Consciousness is the coming together, or contact is the coming together of consciousness with forms through the eye, the coming together of consciousness with sounds through the ear, coming together of consciousness with odors through the nose, and so on. Okay, then contact can be of three kinds of contact. The contact takes place through each of the six sense bases. And each of these six types of contact can be of three qualities. It can be of a kind that is to be felt as pleasant, of a kind that is to be felt as painful, and of a kind that is to be felt neither as painful nor as pleasant. This is what we can call a neutral contact. Then the contact that is to be felt as pleasant gives rise to a pleasant feeling. The contact that is to be felt as painful gives rise to a painful feeling. And the contact that is to be felt neither as painful nor as pleasant gives rise to a neutral feeling, a feeling that's neither pleasant nor painful. And now all of these conditions through which feeling arises are impermanent. In fact, they're all constantly ceasing, constantly coming to an end, moment after moment. And so this is when one cultivates this very constant and continuous mindfulness directed to the six sense faculties that one can experience at the eye or at the ear, at the nose, at the tongue, at the body, in the mind, how there's constantly an arising of contact, a ceasing of contact, and of how with each contact there's an associated feeling, and how that feeling is ceasing with the ceasing of that contact. And so with our ordinary, say, day-to-day consciousness, the way we experience the world, things seem to be solid and substantial, and our own feelings give us the impression of a solid, substantial world. But by directing the attention inwards and close up to our experience from moment to moment, then one can actually penetrate and realize the moment by moment ceasing of this event of contact. And as one experiences the moment to moment ceasing of this event of contact, one experiences the moment to moment ceasing of the feeling that arises based upon that contact. And then the understanding of the impermanence of feeling becomes so important in the Buddhist training, because it is through not understanding feeling that the three latent tendencies or underlying tendencies are activated stimulated and activated, pleasant feeling when it's not understood activates the underlying tendency, the latent tendency to craving, greed, attachment. Painful feeling is that subtle stimulus which activates the underlying tendency to aversion, hatred, ill will. And the neutral feeling, when it's not understood, is what activates the underlying tendency to ignorance or delusion. So this is why the Buddha emphasizes time and again the importance of comprehending the nature of feeling. And Venerable Nandaka here speaks about a noble disciple who sees this as it actually is with samapanyaya pasati. He sees it with proper wisdom, with correct wisdom, who sees the cessation of feeling. When one sees the cessation of feeling through the ceasing of its conditions, then there is no greed for the pleasant feeling, no aversion, no hatred towards the painful feeling, and no delusion or ignorance about the neutral feeling. Okay, now Venerable Nandaka goes on to give another simile, a rather weird one. This is a simile that must have been something that could be readily seen in ancient India in those days. These days we don't see anything like this, because it all goes on behind big stone walls. A skilled butcher or his apprentice might kill a cow and then use his sharp butcher's knife to carve it up. Then without damaging the inner mass of flesh and without damaging the outer hide, he would cut, sever, and carve away the inner tendons, sinews, and ligaments with the sharp butcher's knife. Okay, then having done all this, he would remove the outer hide and cover the cow again with that same hide. Okay, could he rightly say that this cow is joined to this hide just as it was before? Is it possible? Can you milk the cow? Does the cow make any sounds? So the nuns, they say no. Because even though the butcher were to cover the cow again with that same hide, the cow would still be disjoined from that hide. Okay, so this is in paragraph 12, has the application of the simile. And I'm not sure that it really works in every way. It's just a simile. Okay, so the inner mass of flesh is a term for the six internal sense bases, the sense faculties. The Outer hide is a term for the six external bases. Then the inner tendons, sinews, and ligaments is a term for nandi raga. That's delight and lust. In other words, this is another name for craving. And then the sharp butcher's knife is a term for Aryapanya, that's noble wisdom. And this is the noble wisdom that cuts, severs, and carves away the inner defilements, fetters, and bonds. Okay, so normally it is the these inner defilements, fetters, and bonds, or this delight and lust that holds the inner sense bases, the sense faculties, to the sense objects, to the external sense bases. And so because of this delight and lust or craving for the sense objects, the eye is constantly looking for forms, or it's really, it's the mind that is working through the eye, looking for delightful, pleasant forms. The ear is constantly looking, or the mind is looking through the ear for pleasant and delightful sounds. The mind is looking through the nose for pleasant and delightful scents, and so with each of the other senses. So it is this craving working in the mind that holds the inner sense bases, the sense faculties, that binds them and ties them to the outer sense bases, the sense objects. Now, when one develops and cultivates this noble wisdom, then one cuts away these inner defilements, fetters, and bonds. One cuts away this craving, this delight and lust. And so when all of that craving is removed, the sense faculties are still there. The liberated person still has the sense faculties. The sense objects are still there. The liberated person still experiences objects through the sense faculties. But what is missing now is that delight and lust that is binding or tying together the sense faculties to the sense objects. Or we could say more accurately, that's binding the mind through the sense faculties to the sense objects. There's a sutta that comes in Samyutta Nikaya which gives a simile that illustrates this. It's a different simile, but it illustrates this from a different angle. The simile is given of two bulls, a white bull and a black bull, which are tied together by a yoke. And the question is asked, I think it's Sariputta and Mahakotika who are discussing this, is the black bull the fetter for the white bull? Or is the white bull the fetter for the black bull? What is the answer? It's like a riddle. That's it, yeah. The answer is that it's not the black bull that's the fetter for the white bull, and it's not the white bull that's the fetter for the black bull, but it is the yoke that's connecting them that's the fetter between them. And so this simile is used to illustrate that it's not the inner sense base, the sense faculty, that's the fetter for the, binds us to the outer sense object. And it's not the outer sense object that's the fetter that binds us to the sense faculties. But it is this craving or attachment that is the fetter that binds the inner sense bases, the sense faculties, that binds them to the outer sense bases, the sense objects. And then the illustration is given that there is in the Buddha an eye, and the Buddha sees forms with the eye, but the Buddha no longer has any attachment, no longer has any craving for forms, and therefore the Buddha no longer has any bondage. For the Buddha, there's no longer any bondage between his eye and forms. And so with all of the other senses and their objects. Okay, so now in paragraph 12, Venerable Nanda establishes that it's noble wisdom that is the main instrument for cutting away this craving or delight and lust that's the cause of bondage. And now in paragraph 13, he shows what are the conditions for the arising of noble wisdom. And these conditions are the seven enlightenment factors. And so he says these seven there are these seven enlightenment factors by developing which a bhikkhu, a monk, here he should say a bhikkhuni, a nun, by realizing for himself or herself with direct knowledge, enters and dwells in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Okay, so what are the seven enlightenment factors? Okay, first, a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni develops the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. And it's said here to be supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, ripening and relinquishment. Okay, mindfulness is, here it's this continued, careful attention to a sense object, this constant bearing in mind of the meditation object, this constant bearing in mind of the meditation object. Then there comes the investigation of states, investigation of qualities, enlightenment factor. And this is sometimes identified with wisdom, but I don't think that is quite accurate in relation to the enlightenment factors as a series. We could say that the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, is just the very elementary type of wisdom. Because the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, this is the quality by which one investigates one's own states of mind, and one is able to distinguish what are wholesome and unwholesome states of mind. What are good and bad states of mind? What are bright and dark states of mind? and one knows how to overcome the unwholesome, bad, dark states of mind, and how to cultivate and strengthen the wholesome, worthy, bright states of mind. So this is, it's only the second stage in the development of the enlightenment factors. Then comes the energy enlightenment factor. As one goes on developing mindfulness, cleansing one's mind through investigating the states of mind, then energy increases, one's mental energy, one's vigor in the practice. As one becomes more vigorous in one's practice, then there arises this joy and bliss, which is called rapture. Then rapture still has this element of excitement in it, but as one's attention to the meditation object becomes more consistent, more sustained, the mind quiets down and settles more continuously on the object. And so that excitement of rapture subsides and becomes replaced by tranquility, pasuddhi. As the mind becomes tranquil, then one experiences this bliss of body and mind, this glowing happiness. And through that glowing happiness, this tranquil happiness, the mind remains sustained on the object, so that the concentration enlightenment factor becomes prominent. And then as the concentration enlightenment factor gains in strength, then the mind becomes more and more balanced, more and more poised. And so the equanimity enlightenment factor becomes prominent. And then all of these seven enlightenment factors now working together become the supports for this noble wisdom, which is able to cut away the inner defilements, fetters, and bonds. And as that wisdom cuts away all of the fetters and bonds, then one realizes for oneself with direct knowledge, enters and dwells in the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, or better, liberation of mind, the liberation by wisdom, that are taintless with the destruction of the three taints, or the three influxes, the flowing in of craving for sensual pleasures, the craving for continued existence, and the flowing in or influx of ignorance. Okay, with this, the Venerable Nandaka brought his discourse to an end. Okay, I'll finish the sutta, then I'll ask for questions. Then he dismissed the bhikkhunis, telling them that they can go. Okay, then the bhikkhunis went to the Buddha, the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and stood to one side. And the Buddha told them that they could go. I have to say, this is a little bit peculiar here, because at the beginning of the sutta, if you remember, the Venerable Nandaka goes to the monastery for the nuns, the Rajaka Park. Where is this? Page 1120, towards the bottom. Venerable Nandaka goes to the Rajaka Park to instruct the nuns. Yet here, Venerable Nandaka is dismissing the nuns as though the nuns were at the monks' monastery. Then the nuns go to the Buddha as if the Buddha is at, as if this is the Buddha's monastery. And then the Buddha says, you can go, it is time. It seems that there's some inconsistency here. Okay, now after the nuns leave, the Buddha addresses the monks and says, he uses another simile. He says, just as on the Uposatha day of the 14th, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since then the moon is clearly incomplete. So too those bhikkhunis are satisfied with Nandaka's teaching of the Dhamma, but their intention has not yet been fulfilled. Yeah, on the 14th, Uposatha day, that is a day of the dark moon. On that day, the moon is always dark. That's the Uposatha day, that is the day of the religious observance in Buddhism, which occurs either every 2 weeks on the full moon day and on the new moon day, the day of the dark moon. And most of those are 15th of the fortnight of the 2 week period. But the third Uposatha and the seventh Uposatha in the three main seasons of the Buddha's calendar, those are the Uposatha's days of the 14th. And those are always the third Uposatha, the seventh Uposatha, those are necessarily new moon days when the moon is a dark moon. So one can see clearly that the moon is incomplete. And so the Buddha says that the bhikkhunis, now their intention has not yet been fulfilled. It's like the moon on that new moon day. It's like a dark moon. Okay, now on the next day, the Buddha addresses the Venerable Nanda and says to Nandaka, tomorrow you should instruct those bhikkhunis in exactly the same way. The commentary said that the Buddha considered how could those nuns be instructed in such a way that they could reach the fulfillment of their intention, so that they could reach some stage of realization. And then when the Buddha considered this question, he understood that if Nandaka were to instruct the nuns on the very next day, the nuns would be able to achieve realization. And he wanted Nandaka to teach them exactly in the same way, and by teaching them in that same way, they would be able to reach realization. Okay, so now Nandaka agreed, and then the text says, the next morning the Venerable Nandaka dressed and so on, and then it repeats the same sutta, the Pali repeats the same thing, the instruction, the discourse is exactly the same, up to the point where the nuns come to the Buddha, pay homage to him, and then depart. Then the Buddha says, just as on the Uposatha day of the 15th, that is the full moon day, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since then the moon is clearly full, so too those bhikkhunis are satisfied with Nandaka's teaching of the Dhamma, and their intention has been fulfilled. Then the Buddha says, even the least advanced of those 500 bhikkhunis is a stream enterer, no longer subject to the lower world, to rebirth in the lower worlds, bound for liberation, headed for enlightenment. Okay, this is what the Pali text says. Now, an interesting variation, to which I'm indebted to my friend Venerable Analio and his sutta study. He's done a comparative study of this Pali version of the sutta with its Chinese counterparts, so counterparts in Chinese translation. And he's found that there are two Chinese counterparts coming from different early Buddha schools. And in both of those counterparts, when Venerable Nandaka completes his first discourse to the nuns attain the stage of non-returner. That is, they end up at the third stage of enlightenment, the third of the fourth stage. And in that way, their intention has not yet been fulfilled. Then when Nandaka gives his discourse the next day, then they reach arhatship. Then what's interesting is there's a comment in the Anguttara Nikaya. There's a little sutta where the Buddha pronounces this Venerable Nandaka the chief monk amongst those who give discourses to the nuns, the top instructor of the nuns. And then the commentary to that gives an account of this sutta. And in the commentary to that, this Anguttara Nikaya commentary, when it relates the sutta, it says that after Nandaka gave his first discourse to the nuns achieved, if I remember correctly, the stages of stream entry, once returner, and non-returner. And then when he gave his second discourse the next day, then they achieved arhatship. So here the Anguttara Nikaya commentary is pretty much in agreement with the versions of the discourse that have come down from the other early Buddha schools and been translated into Chinese. But it is different from the version of the sutta that has come into the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, now I'll ask if there are any questions. Yeah.
Would you explain the meaning that their intention has not yet been fulfilled? And what's the meaning of their intention?
The meaning of intention, the way it's expressed, okay, taking it the way it's understood in the Majjhima Nikaya, here it means that they had not achieved any stage of realization. Maybe that's not correct. But they were aspiring to reach, each one was aspiring to reach certain stages of realization. But they had not yet attained, this is the way it's to be understood in the Majjhima Nikaya. Each one was aspiring to reach a certain stage of realization, but they had not yet reached the stage of realization that they had been aspiring to reach. So in the Majjhima Nikaya, when the Buddha says their intention has been fulfilled in paragraph 27, then he says even the least advanced of these 500 bhikkhunis is a stream enterer. That would imply that some of them were aspiring just to become a stream enterer in this life, not aspiring to go any further. Whereas some could have been aspiring to become once returners, some aspiring to become non-returners, some aspiring to become arahants.
What is the Pali word for here, intention? Is there anything in connection with the second factor of the Eightfold Path?
It's sankappa. It's the word sankappa. Yeah, it's the same word.
So could it mean that they have some right view but have not yet developed to intention?
No, because the word sankappa has several shades of meaning. Here, the sense is more that their aspiration has not been fulfilled.
That is to say that they do not have such a strong desire or intention to let go of these craving for these feelings. Non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. They know these kind of teachings, but this intention to have non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion is not right enough. Is that the meaning here? Can it be interpreted in this way?
I wouldn't understand it in such a technical way as that. I would understand it simply in the sense that their aspiration has not yet been fulfilled. But I find the way it's explained in the Anguttara Nikaya commentary makes better sense than the ending that we have here. Because normally one would have the intention being fulfilled signifying the achievement of arhatship. And so in the ending given to the sutta, the way it's recounted in the Anguttara Nikaya commentary, their intention is said to be fulfilled when they achieve arhatship. And that is also the ending which is given in the versions of the sutta that comes down in Chinese translation. But I wouldn't try to connect the word sankappa here with samma sankappa of the Noble Eightfold Path. I think that would be forcing it into too narrow a sense. Okay, Tom.
The ignorance that you're thinking about regarding the latent tendency to mental feeling, isn't that, that's a different ignorance from the taint? Isn't that more of an ignorance of that? Isn't that more of just a lack of awareness of that mental feeling versus a ignorance referred
to? Yeah, that's a good point. One could say that it's also the taint of ignorance, but it's the taint of ignorance because it's the taint of ignorance that's operative there. But here it's working in a more narrow and specific way. Whereas when one speaks about the taint of ignorance or the influx of ignorance, that is ignorance in its broadest, most all-embracing meaning. But when it's spoken of just in relation to the neutral feeling, that's taking it in a more specific and a narrower sense. But it's still basically the same mental quality. George.
Is there a reason why the seven enlightenment factors are brought in at this point? We go through the impermanence of the senses and sense faces and the feelings, and then talk about the enlightenment factors.
The way I would understand it, and this is what's also said in the commentary, is to show the supporting conditions for the arising of this noble, for that noble wisdom that cuts away the inner defilements, fetters, and bonds. That's the way I would see it. One could have brought in the four foundations of mindfulness, but probably these nuns were more advanced in their practice already, so they would have probably already been well established in the four foundations of mindfulness. And so then by bringing in the seven enlightenment factors, the seven enlightenment factors emerge from the four foundations of mindfulness. They sort of spiral out of it, out of them.
It seems like the monks get it right away and get their realization instantly, but the nuns needed two tries. They're like, 35 women.
That's a good point. I mean, I have to say it. We have to remember that the texts were compiled by monks. And it could be a kind of, what do you call this, a gender biased recension or gender biased presentation in the text.
But didn't he say that he was at first a reluctant teacher? Right.
Yeah.
He just didn't do a very good job.
But don't forget also that there are many, many monks who didn't get it after many, many teachings. So I read somebody had made the comment, this was the interesting point, that what's said is that in the Pali version, it said that Nandaka gives exactly the same teaching the second time. Whereas in the version that come down in the two other schools that have been translated into Chinese, it's not said that he gave exactly the same teaching. It's just that he went and he taught the nuns, and then after his teaching, the nuns achieved the fulfillment of their intention, and then the Buddha says that they achieved arhatship. So that would be actually quite remarkable that 500 of them, or a great, very large number of them, achieved arhatship just getting two teachings, one after another. So that's actually quite complimentary. But somebody that I read commenting on the sutta, I don't remember who, said that the Pali version, that maybe this is a biased remark coming from this writer, whoever it was, I don't remember, is sort of indicating that, please excuse me, but this is their point of view, not my own. The text is showing that the nuns are a little bit dull because they need the same thing repeated a second time the very next day in order to get it. Anyway, I don't...
We're talking about, by the end of the sutta, one of their
and this one there's three mentors, and the other one there are arahants. But going back to paragraph 6, because Venerable Sir, we have already seen this well as it actually is a proper wisdom thus.
Yeah.
Does that not indicate any sort of attainment?
It doesn't necessarily imply the attainment of a stage of like stream entry. Because it could be that they have just seen this well with the proper wisdom of insight, with insight wisdom. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have seen this with what's called the wisdom of the noble path. In fact, if I remember correctly, the commentary sort of makes its point of explaining with proper wisdom, it says with insight wisdom, rather than saying with insight wisdom and path wisdom, in order to indicate that the nuns are not necessarily stream enterers. I'm trying to think whether Mahapajapati Gotami was a stream enterer.
You mentioned that she was at the beginning of it.
Oh, she was a stream enterer already. She had become a stream enterer when she was still a laywoman. Right. But probably it's not her, but the other. In fact, she became an arhant not through the teaching of Nandaka. She became an arhant through a teaching that the Buddha gave to her. So I think she is just leading the 500 nuns, but she has already completed her attainment already. So she's not sort of being counted within them.
Or maybe she had an intention set for higher. Maybe she achieved a higher state by the end of the Sutta, better intention maybe on once return.
No, I think she had already achieved arhatship before the Sutta began, yeah. Of course, shortly after she became a bhikkhuni, she got an instruction directly from the Buddha, and then she went and practiced on the basis of that instruction, and then it said that she achieved arhatship. Okay, I think we have to stop now. Okay, we end with a sharing of the merits. Share the merits with the Dhamma protecting deities, the other powerful spirit beings, and with all other beings in need of merits, asking them to protect the true Dhamma, to protect the world, and to achieve the fulfillment of all of their good wishes. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang. Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.